Greek philosopher Aristotle called it practical wisdom. We know it as common sense. Is there a lack of it in our society? This hour, we listen back to my conversation with political science professor Kenneth Sharp. Together with Barry Schwartz, Sharp has written a book which argues that much of our dissatisfaction with institutions today is because people within the system aren't allowed to use their practical wisdom or common sense. No new calls this hour, but we will hear from IPR listeners who recount instances from their lives when common sense was abundant or abundantly lacking. Is a dose of practical wisdom missing from our society? Find out after this news. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. The Greek philosopher Aristotle called it practical wisdom. That was about 2,500 years ago. These days we refer to it most often as common sense. This hour, we ask if many of the institutions upon which we depend lack that quality. My guest is political science professor Kenneth Sharp. Together with Barry Schwartz, Sharp has written a new book which argues that much of our dissatisfaction with institutions today is because people within the system aren't allowed to use their practical wisdom. The title of the book is Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. Kenneth Sharp is a professor of political science at Swarthmore College. He specializes in political philosophy, public policy, and U.S. foreign policy. He joins us for the hour by phone from Pennsylvania, I believe. Good afternoon to you.
Nice to be with you, Ben. Thanks.
Great to have you with us. And you have so many terrific real-life stories in this book to point out the case that you were making along with Barry Schwartz. Start off, please, by telling us a favorite story where you found practical wisdom missing.
Let me tell you, I'll tell you a story that's actually not in the book that happened recently that would have been in the book. I was on a train heading up to Dartmouth College coming through New England on an Amtrak train, and the cars were almost empty, only a few people left as we were about an hour away from our destination, and there was an elderly woman, Thelma we'll call her, who was sitting a few seats ahead of me. And she signaled the conductor to come over and give her a hand. She was very worried that when she arrived in the White River train station, she wouldn't be able to get a cab to take her to the retirement home that she lived in. And she asked the conductor if he could help. And the conductor, standing, he's probably 6'2", kind of looking down at her, said, "I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. That's a matter that's off the train. If it's something on the train," he said, "I can take care of anything. I could even marry a couple if I wanted. I'm the captain of the ship here, but anything to do off the train, sorry, can't be of help." And she pleaded a bit more, and he just said, "You know, wish I could do something, but the rule's a rule." And he kind of saunters off, and about 10 minutes later, the assistant conductor comes wandering down, just doing a check, and she calls him over, and she asks him the same question. And his way of handling it then is just totally different. He leans over, comes down to her level. He looks at her so he can listen to her. She explains the problem, needs to get a cab. He reassures her that there'll be a cab because it's a big station, but she says she walks very slowly and she's worried that they might not wait for her. And he says, "Well, do you have a cell phone?" And she says, "Yes." He says, do you feel comfortable using it?" And she says, "Yes." He said, "Well, you wait right here." And he goes off to the front of the train, uses his cell phone to get the number of the cab line in White River Junction, comes back, gives her the number, gets reassurance from her that she'll be okay. She calls the cab and makes a reservation. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there just watching this interaction. Two conductors, one a strict rule follower, didn't do anything wrong according to the rules, but the whole purpose of being a conductor is to assist and aid the passengers, particularly somebody who's elderly and scared. And this other conductor didn't really break any rules, but he knew how to bend the rule. He knew he could figure out a workaround, and he did that not just because he was probably a very caring person, but also because he had a certain kind of, think in the book we call it a moral skill. He could figure out how to solve that problem in a way that allowed her to get what she needed, allowed him to be a good conductor, didn't break any rules. And I was just sitting there watching that with my mouth open, as that kind of comparison of someone who had the practical wisdom to do his job well versus someone who was just a kind of strict rule follower. And to me, it really sums up a lot of what we were trying to get at the book.
And a little later, we want to talk more about the rules, having too many rules, and also incentives, which it can also be a problem. And but first, I wanted you to share another story, in particular one that public radio listeners may be acquainted with. It was a story of a father and a son going to a ballpark in Michigan, I believe.
Yes.
Tell us that story.
Yes, this was a story of a father who's an academic, an anthropologist, takes his kid to a Cubs game. The kid's thirsty. Dad says, "No problem, I'll get you a drink. What do you want?" Kid says, "Lemonade." Dad goes off, buys the lemonade, has no clue that there's something called hard lemonade, which is different than regular lemonade. So he buys him Mike's hard lemonade and brings it to the kid, who, happily drinks away at it. And then a policeman at the station, at the ballpark, spots this kid, this 9-year-old, drinking Mike's hard lemonade, and calls the father over, tells him that alcohol is prohibited to minors. The father says, "I had no idea there was any alcohol in it." The policeman says, "I'm sorry, but regulations say that, I've got to call in an intervention team." And they bring in a social worker, and they bring in an ambulance. The kid is taken away and checked for alcohol levels. The father's taken before a judge, who also says, "I really hate to do this, but the rule's the rule, and you're not going to be able to take your kid home. We're worried about child abuse. He can go home with his mother, but you're going to have to sleep at a hotel." And when the dust clears, it's 2 weeks before the father can go home.
Amazing.
And the whole idea that those rules are in place, not for bad purposes, Ben. They're there for a good reason. They're there to make sure that public officials keep their eyes open for child abuse and minors taking alcohol. But you needed people, the policemen, social workers, medical workers, and a judge who had the good judgment or the practical wisdom to know when a kid drinking Mike's hard lemonade is a problem and when it's just an accident.
Kenneth Sharp is with us, sharing a story of hard lemonade found in his book, co-written with Barry Schwartz, Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. In the book, the authors argue that some of our dissatisfaction with institutions today is because people within the system aren't allowed to use their practical wisdom. They're a slave to rules, and we want to reach out this hour to find out from our listeners if you have similar stories. Can you recall, Exchange listeners, an instance where perhaps you were dealing with, a doctor's office, a school system, a bank, perhaps in the courts, some facet of life, and you said to yourself, you got yourself enmeshed in something or witnessed something where you said, "This really doesn't make much sense. This could be solved in a much easier way using some practical wisdom or what we call common sense." 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, to tell us your story where someone used their practical wisdom or where you saw a dramatic lack of practical wisdom, as we just heard in that hard lemonade story. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. So when you define practical wisdom, what are its attributes? How do we know it when we see it?
To know it when you see it, you often have to be somewhat skilled or knowledgeable about the practice. So parents can often identify when other parents lack practical wisdom with their taking care of their children, or patients can often identify it when they've had experience with doctors. Doctors certainly know when they're dealing with other doctors. Practical wisdom is really the right way to do the right thing. It's a kind of know-how. One of the ways we think about it is almost the same way we would think about somebody having a craft. It's not the theory. It's not the abstract idea of always be honest or always be kind or always give a patient freedom of choice or always do for the patient what you think it's best. It's like the craftsman who has to look at the materials and the circumstance and the context and decide how to measure something, how many times to cut something, exactly how to put a pipe together, and has learned that not just by learning the rules, but through the experience to exercise judgment of what to do in special circumstances. And that's the kind of moral know-how that we need to actually figure out when to be angry at our child and when to be patient at our child, as opposed to having a rule that you should never be angry or always be patient. Sometimes one is appropriate. That depends on the context. You know that context usually by having had the experience and the practice and figuring out what to do. So it's Barry and I are particularly sensitive to this as teachers, because we've come to understand that you can't teach this in an ethics class. You can't give people rules or principles and send them out in the world and think that if they follow them, they're going to do good. They're a good starting place, but ultimately they're going to have to figure out which rules to apply, when, how, when to make exceptions, what to do when two principles like honesty and kindness conflict with each other. So practical wisdom is like the know-how a craftsman, a moral craftsman, needs to do the right thing in the right way. And our argument in the book is that we all need to be moral craftsmen, not just sages or clerics.
Your stories of practical wisdom or a lack thereof that you've witnessed or experienced yourself, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. Bill is our first caller for this hour, joining us from Mount Vernon. Good afternoon, Bill.
Well, good afternoon, and thanks for your show. It's a subject near and dear to my heart.
Oh, tell us, where have you encountered a lack of practical wisdom?
Well, I'm an electrician, and I'm 62 years old now, so I run into that all the time. It's a trade joke with electrical engineers and their designs.
For example?
The first example that comes to mind is a favorite story of mine, where a large grandstand was built for a rodeo arena out in Wyoming, and when the final inspection came through, it seems that a door to one of those concessions, when it swung open, covered the electrical equipment in the electrical room, which is a violation of the National Electric Code. And so three electrical engineers and a mechanical engineer and a county inspector scratched their head for 3 or 4 days, and finally I said, you know, is it possible to put the hinge on that door the other way so the door swings the other way, and all the light bulbs went off?
That's a beautiful example.
And I'm not a door person. I'm an electrical person. But
Reminds me of the joke where you have trouble with a door. You'd say, you got to be smarter than the door, folks.
That's exactly right. Another example, we were building a brand new museum, an archaeological museum, and it was very intricate lighting where when the public came in to view different displays, certain light shows would happen at that display. So it was pretty intricate control systems that operated that. Well, when we finished the job, we had 500 pounds of controllers and relays and that were not necessary. And the electrical engineers came onto the site, and we did a walkthrough and said, well, yeah, this worked. And after we did the 57 items that worked the way they still were scratching their heads, where did that 500 pounds of all of this control equipment get left over, and how did they over-design? They still never understood it. But we guys who actually put it in knew precisely what it needed and not one extra thing.
Thank you, Bill, for those two instances.
You bet.
Bill from Mount Vernon, thanks for joining us. Let's go to our next caller. Let's go to Terry. Terry is joining us from Des Moines. Good afternoon, Terry.
Hi. I had an instance of this with Iowa student loan, actually, and there was a mistake in which my automatic deposit didn't go in when I first got out of college, and they called me and said they'd put my account on hold while they got it all figured out, but they mistakenly didn't put it on hold, and then so my account went into default 30 days and then 60 days, all the while I was trying to pay them, you know, and when it came down to it, after we got it all sorted out, I you know, ended up with some pretty bad credit. And I went back to them. They said that legally they are obligated to report exactly what happened, even though they acknowledged their mistake and that it was their mistake and not necessarily my mistake, because I had trusted this, that they had said what they were going to do. That legally, credit reporting, they're obligated to say what happened and not give any explanation. So I, Hannah, ran into this in the same instance where it's like, you know, an honest mistake between two companies, and I'm the loser.
Right. It left a big black mark on your credit rating. Yeah. That's certainly people relying on rules. You can't take it back then, huh?
And if just one person pushed back and asked, you know, why is it this way? You know, we're just going to, you know, look the other way, because we understand, even though the credit bureau says this, you know, or says that you have to legally report it, you know, it would be a completely different story. But it feels like, because they have to follow the letter of the law, there's no room for judgment at all.
What frustration. Terry, thank you for sharing your story. I hope it didn't have too many ramifications for you.
You know, Terry's story is really just perfect, as Bill's was, because in her story, you can understand why you have those kinds of rules. And maybe in 90% of the cases, those rules work. But when they break down, there's no super rule that tells you that they've broken down. There's no super rule that says you need to make an exception. You have to have people on the spot, the people at the other end of the phone line, the people that are administering the student loans, a manager who's got the judgment or the wisdom to say, okay, there was a mistake here, and take responsibility for making an exception and for rectifying it so that the rule doesn't end up serving the absolute opposite purpose from what it was created. So that the importance of having the good character and the good judgment, the practical wisdom to know what to do in those situations, is something that people have to be trained for and given the discretion to do, so that we don't experience, as we all do, the kinds of experiences Terry had.
Chris is joining us from West Des Moines, undoubtedly with another story of a lack of practical wisdom, is it, Chris?
Yes, yeah.
Tell us the story.
I think you're going to get a lot of those today. anyway, this was about 25 years ago, and thinking about it, I mean, I still feel it. You know, what happened was I was taking a shower, and there was a minor earthquake, and I slipped and cut my knee open really bad. It was about a 6-inch gash straight across my knee and a lot of blood. And I bandaged it up as best I could, but I knew I couldn't be seen if I didn't have any money. I lived in Los Angeles, and the rules, you just can't walk into somewhere unless it's the county hospital. And I knew that was like an hour away from where I was, so I knew I couldn't deal with that. So I went to my bank, and as I went into the bank, I realized it was still bleeding, or it started bleeding again. So I went in the bathroom, wrapped it up a little more, and I got a little blood on the bathroom floor, and I tried to clean it up, and then I went and got in line, and I think it was still bleeding then, because while I was standing in line, a police officer and a couple EMTs came up to me, and they had been called by the bank, and I said, well, I'm waiting in line, I'm just trying to get some money so I can actually be seen. And they said, no, we'll take care of it, we'll take you in, we'll take you to the hospital. So I went with them because I really didn't have any choice when you have a police officer telling you that. But they took me to the hospital. At the hospital, in the emergency room, they said, well, we can't sew it up. All we can do is stop the bleeding and bandage it up. So they did this. Then they let me go. Well, I had to walk a little over a mile back to my car to go into the bank, get money, and then drive back to the hospital to actually get it sewn up.
Oh, Chris, that is a story. Comment on that, Kenneth. That might be for your next edition, huh?
Yeah, that's almost as bad or as good, depending how you look at it, as the lemonade story. So, Chris, they wouldn't sew it up at the hospital because you weren't covered and didn't have the money. Is that why they couldn't actually stitch it?
Yeah. They had some, you know, their rules were rules that, you know, because it was an emergency, they had to stop the bleeding, which meant just, I don't know, doing something to the vein that was pumping out the blood, but they couldn't actually sew it up.
Right. And again, you know, what's so striking about that story, Chris, is that I think if you talk to any of the people at the hospital who were treating you, they would have wanted to have sewn that up. It wasn't, they knew that was the right thing to do, is to sew it up. They probably felt for you. They would have liked to do it, but they were concerned somehow that they would be punished, that their job required that they follow those rules and regulations. So they themselves were put in a position where they couldn't actually do the medical practice that they were trained to do because they didn't have the discretion to bend the rule in that particular case.
Chris, thank you for your call and your story, and undoubtedly a nice scar you can remember that story with.
Yeah. Thank you. And this is really interesting. I mean, you know, it's on some ends it's awful to hear that this stuff happens to everybody, and on the other end it's good to hear that it happens to everybody, because then maybe people listening who are the people responsible for that kind of thing can say, okay, well, we'll give you this much discretion to take care of this or that little thing.
And we do want to talk about that, especially in our second half hour, how you develop practical wisdom, how it can be developed in our institutions. But first of all, I'd like to ask, before we take a break in 2 or 3 minutes, Kenneth Sharp, I want to ask you, make the case for us quickly that you argue in the book that our disenchantment with society is in part based on the fact that we have neglected this idea of practical wisdom, and that the stories that are lighting up our phone lines right now are not just little nuisances in our life, but fit into a bigger picture.
They absolutely fit into a bigger picture, whether it's healthcare institutions or court systems or law firms or classrooms or even the way military and police are sometimes organized on the ground, that there's a notion as bureaucracies grow bigger or as the pressure for profit goes greater, depending on whether you're talking about a state institution or a private institution, that the way you can get people to act in the way that the managers want is by adding more rules or more incentives to their behavior. The more complex these organizations get, the more layers of rules and incentives happen. And then when something happens, like the story that that Chris was telling at the hospital, the response is often, we need a new rule to cover that particular case, where what they really needed was the training of people to have the character to know what to do and an administrative structure which allowed for some discretion in particular cases. But our disenchantment is so great because we don't get the services we want because people never don't have the time to get to know us, don't know what we need because of that time bind, or have to follow rules, whether it's in the classroom or the medical center. So we're disenchanted. And I think the thing that Barry and I found as we did the book, it's not just we who are disenchanted with the professional services that we're being given, but the professionals themselves are disenchanted. That's why I made the point to Chris about the doctors. They don't like to see patients in 7 minutes. They don't like to have a set of regulations which prevents them from doing the kind of treatment that they know is best for the patient. So you've really set up a system that undermines the very purposes of the judicial and health and teaching and other institutions we have. It's a very serious problem, we think.
More of our conversation with Kenneth Sharp, professor of political science at Swarthmore College. He's co-author of the book Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. We're not taking any phone calls this hour, as we're listening back to the great input from our listeners when this program originally aired in January of last year. We're talking about experiences witnessing or being enmeshed in instances of practical wisdom, or a lack thereof. In the next half hour, we'll talk about how we can develop practical wisdom on an individual level and also a societal level. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us for this encore edition of the program. The Right Way to Do the Right Thing is the subtitle of Kenneth Sharp's book he wrote together with Barry Schwartz, and it argues that much of our dissatisfaction with institutions today is because people within the system aren't allowed to use their practical wisdom. This results in frustration for us, those who are dealing with these institutions, receiving these services, and also for those, as Kenneth Sharp pointed out, giving these services. They wish they could act otherwise, but they are dealing with a whole lot of rules in many cases. And we want to hear your stories of practical wisdom or a lack thereof that you've witnessed in your life, that you've encountered, that you've been frustrated with. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Also cases where you saw practical wisdom shine through the muck of over regulation, if we can say it that way. 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Almost misspoke there, Kenneth. We are we talking not about deregulation in that sense, are we?
No, that would suggest that rules are never good and unimportant, and anyone that's lived through the financial debacle of the last couple of years would be unwise to make that argument. You've got to have the kind of framework that rules give and the kind of guidance that rules give. It's just that within inside those rules and guidelines, you need to train people to know how to apply them and when to bend them and what to do when they conflict with each other. And if they're bad rules that are misleading or bad incentives that are pointing people to purposes that aren't the purposes of banking or medicine or law practice, then those structures have to be changed. You can't just depend on people doing the right thing and a structure that incentivizes the wrong thing.
Right. Often in the workplace, you have those two solutions as fixes, the rules and incentives. You've spoken quite a bit about rules, but give us an example of where incentives can work against best outcomes.
Well, one of the things that incentives do is they teach people to think about the wrong things. One of the research papers that we found very useful on this was a study that some psychologists and sociologists did of parents at an Israeli daycare center. The daycare center was having problems of parents coming to pick up their kids late. Not a lot of parents, just a few, but all the teachers at the daycare center couldn't go home and leave the kids, so they had to wait till the parents came back. So they came up with an idea of giving the parents a negative incentive, you might say, a fine, and they told the parents that if they were late to pick up their kids, they would have a small fine. I think the initial fine was about $15 or $20. And as soon as they instituted that fine, the rate of lateness by parents to pick up their kids actually began to increase. And it began to increase because the parents, instead of having the kind of moral reason to come and pick up their kids, that this was not something that they should do to the kids' teachers, leave them standing there, they began to think about the problem as an economic problem. They began to think about the fine as a price, and they said to themselves, well, you know, I'm busy at work, big deal coming down. Is it worth $15 or $20 for me to be a half hour late? Did the calculation. Yes, it is. And they began to pay for their lateness as opposed to being on time because they had an obligation to be that way. So the school actually raised the price or the fine, which the parents were looking at as a price, and the rates of lateness actually went up even further. And after 6 months, they threw up their hands in desperation, and they removed the fine, and the rates went up yet even further. And what the researchers concluded was that not only didn't the incentives work, but the incentives actually undermined the moral reasons, the internal incentives that people had to do the right thing by getting them to think about the right thing in terms of money, getting them to think about it as a price they'd be willing to pay. And that's the danger of incentives, that they get people, they often do work. I mean, if they had raised that fine to $1,000 per lateness fee, I'm sure you could have gotten the fine to work. But the important thing about incentives is that you're often incentivizing people in ways that undermine the internal reasons they have for doing the right thing, and then you've got trouble. There's lots of other experiments and research like that, but we'll leave it at that one for now.
Kenneth Sharp, many people wanting to share their stories of practical wisdom or a lack thereof. Let's go to Judy in Martinsdale. Hi, Judy. Thanks for joining our program.
Good morning. Very interesting program, and it brought back memories from when I was a manager, and I was a manager in a hospital that had opened a fitness center for its employees. And all the employees were allowed a half an hour for lunch hour. And I had an employee who worked for another supervisor who had asked if she could have a 45-minute lunch hour, which would allow her to exercise as well as then shower and change. And her supervisor had refused that, saying, nope, everybody gets a half hour, that's it. And she came to me and asked for redress. And she had been willing to give up her other breaks throughout the day and only take this one break. And her going to work out would not have unduly burdened her coworkers in the least. And when she came to me, I was reminded of a book that I had read by James Autry called The Art of Caring Leadership. And in that book, he has a wonderful chapter about how everybody gets special treatment. And so I helped her supervisor see that it would not hurt the workplace in the least and, in fact, help this woman to be able to work out over her noon hours. And if anybody asks, well, how come she gets 45 minutes and we only get a half hour, the answer I gave was, well, everybody gets special treatment around here. Mm. If you need special treatment in another way, come to us and we'll look at you as a unique individual and not just as cogs in the work wheel.
Kenneth Sharp, Judy's example there, a good one of practical wisdom?
It's an excellent example. And one of the things I want to underline about it is it's not just that Judy was caring, and it's not just that she knew the right thing to do in that particular case, but as a good manager, she had also learned the skill to carry it out. There are lots of ways that Judy could have handled that problem with the woman superior. She could have ordered him or her to do something differently. She could have had a confrontation. She could have written an email. She could have written a memo. Instead, what she did is she sat down with this person, and Judy had the skill to explain what the purpose of caring was inside that institution, show how it could be in everybody's common interest to do this, and actually convince the person, not just read them the rule of caring or making exceptions, but actually used it as a chance to teach the other person how to think about the problem. That's the kind of skill that a really good manager or administrator needs in order to do the right thing. So you've got to have the caring. You have to have that sense of purpose, but you also have to have the language and the skill, which my guess is that Judy probably learned on the job.
Judy, thanks for that great example. Continued good luck with managing people.
Well, I'm retired now, so I can listen to your program without interruption, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right, Judy, thank you from Martinsdale. Let's go to John in Fairfield. John, thank you for waiting. You have an encounter with practical wisdom or a lack thereof?
Yes, I do. I want to talk about the automated phone answering systems that are used by large corporations and government agencies, particularly like the IRS and Social Security. I've found that almost every time I call, I spend 10 or 15 minutes sometimes answering these questions about my personal background, my mother's maiden name, and so forth. And then they'll ask you, what is your situation? What would you like to ask about? And when I state that, the voice comes back and says, I'm sorry, that was too many words for us to understand. Would you state it again? Well, likely or not, what I want to talk about can't be explained in three or four words. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. And you've just spent 10 minutes there, and at the end, the machine can't understand you, so you flunk out, so to speak.
Exactly. And so finally you get someone who doesn't know anything about what you want, so they put you back through the system again. And what I think in generally speaking is that these answering systems are designed to take care of questions that are right in the middle of the policy of the institution. But if you want to know something that's not quite in the center of things, they don't have a way to deal with it.
Very.
Can I respond to that?
Yes.
John has really hit a very important problem. If you go backwards for a minute, those automated machines have often replaced automated people, people who were trained just to do routine answers for questions. So the machines, in some sense, come in and they try to find a program with a set of rules and algorithms that can answer each issue. But in fact, most of the kinds of problems that people have, when it's not just a factual question, they're problems in which the context is very important. As John said, it's not something that can be explained in a couple of words, and it's often something that needs to be talked through. In order for someone to give service to the client, like John, they have to have the empathy to be able to understand what John is thinking and feeling. They have to understand his confusion. They have to understand his frustration. They have to understand his anger. An automated machine or an automaton-type person can't understand it. It takes somebody with empathetic skills to be able to listen carefully and to figure out what's appropriate for John. And again, I come back to that theme that I mentioned earlier, Ben. It's not just that that's going to be good for John. It's actually going to be good for whatever agency or company that's providing the service, because they're going to have people that appreciate that service and come back, people who are grateful and thankful. So you're getting frustration on the part of the customers or clients, and you're also actually undermining what the purpose of that agency is. And it's all in the name of efficiency, which turns out to be highly inefficient in the end.
Right. And how many of us, we've all had the experience of not making that call when we actually do need a help from some sort of institution, because we know we'll be stuck for how many minutes in some kind of phone tree and perhaps get frustrated, as John did there in Fairfield. John, thank you for your call and that instance.
If I might say one more thing, I think, am I on?
Yes, you are. Go ahead, John.
I think a solution to this, I've often thought, in order to create that empathy that your guest is talking about, is to abolish the whole system and hire a few people who are trained to know everything that goes on in all of the departments, where you can call and get a person on the line who is trained in exactly that empathy of listening to what the person is saying and direct his call that way.
Very good. Thank you, John. We want to finish up the hour, too, by having Kenneth talk about solutions, as you just alluded to, John. You've got canny outlaws, a term used in the book, and also system changers. These are people with solutions. Tell us about them.
Yeah, the canny outlaws were the people who first struck us. These were people who tried to find workarounds to the rules and do the right thing in some sense in spite of the rules. We didn't do a full discussion with Judy, who called earlier, but she's a kind of canny outlaw who finds a way to make things work inside the system. We found teachers who were handed scripted curricula that really demanded that they follow a kind of lockstep teaching method to prepare their students for high-stakes tests. And these were experienced teachers who knew they had to adjust what they were teaching to particular students, but they also knew that somebody, some supervisor, could be walking into their classroom at any time to make sure that if it was day 53, they were on the scripted curricula for day 53. And what we found so refreshing was the number of canny outlaws amongst the teachers who found ways that they could follow the letter of the law, get their students prepared for the standardized tests, however good or bad they were, but squirrel away enough time to do the real teaching and teaching the kind of passion and creativity that their students needed. But the thing about canny outlaws is that it puts the term, which we love, and we love the people we talk to that were canny outlaws, it puts the burden for change just on the courageous individual who's got the wisdom to do the workaround. And we were much more interested in the people that we called system changers. And I'll give you a quick example of one. There are a lot in the book. But one we were particularly struck with was a Buffalo judge, Judge Russell, in Buffalo, New York, who was faced with veterans that were coming into his court system, people, vets back mostly from Afghanistan and Iraq. They'd had serious problems that were usually war-related, PTSD, alcoholism, drug problems, mental illness. Many of them came back and didn't have jobs, and some of them turned to felonies and petty crimes out of desperation or a need to support themselves, including one fellow that we talked about, Pettengill, a fellow named Gary Pettengill, who was actually taking marijuana for his back pain and then selling small quantities of it basically to support his wife and children. And Russell was in this position of having to follow the state's mandatory minimum sentencing laws, in which these dozens of vets that were coming back in, he would have to put in jail for 5 or 10 or 15 years with very little discretion or choice because the rules ruled out judgment in those cases, like the three strikes you're out laws. And what he did was he developed a special veterans court. He got help from the VA, from social workers, from prosecutors, from attorneys, got support inside the court system. So the vets that came to his court agreed to plead guilty to whatever charge that they had done, but they were mandated not just into treatment, but into a mentoring program with another vet. They got help finding housing. They got help with job training. They had to report back to the court every 2 weeks and see Judge Russell again to tell them what their progress were. They did have the rule or the regulation still hanging over them that if they weren't able to complete the treatment and go straight, that they could risk going back into regular court and getting the mandatory sentencing. So the rule was still out there. But what Russell did was he created a court system, a veterans court, something like some of the drug courts that have been created in other parts of the country, that actually encourage judges to use what they're trained to do, which is their judgment or practical wisdom. And he got extraordinary results, almost a zero recidivism rate. And now there are almost 30 veterans courts in the last 2 years since he started this in Buffalo that have sprung up all over the country. So just a great example of somebody who says, I'm going to rejigger the institution. I'm going to change the system so that judgment becomes part of the job, and I don't have to be a canny outlaw in order to do the right thing.
Finishing up our hour with Kenneth Sharp, Practical Wisdom, the title of his new book. Let's go to Carolyn and Malcolm. Carolyn, do you have a story for us?
Well, I do. I thought of this story when Mr. Sharp spoke of an overarching principle that can supersede the rule. I was on chaplaincy duty at a hospital one night, and I was called to come and speak to a woman who was very distraught because her significant other was in critical condition. He had been her husband, but she had divorced him because he was an alcoholic, though they had never lived apart. And they had three daughters together, the whole family, the three daughters, the two of them still lived together, always had. And his siblings didn't like her because she had divorced him. So they had instructed the nurses that they were to receive all of the updates on his condition because she was out of the picture.
Mm-hmm. We have just about a minute left, Carolyn.
Okay. Yeah. To make the long story short, I was so incensed by the situation that I called the attorney for the hospital and laid it before him and said, what can I do about this? This is not right. And he said, well, technically, his siblings are not next of kin. His daughters are his next of kin, and she is guardian of the daughters, so she gets the information. I said, please call the nurse's station and tell them that. And he did, and it worked out.
Very good for finding a solution, Carolyn.
And I didn't find it, but I just knew it was wrong, and the attorney found it for me.
Carolyn, thank you for that great example. Calling from Malcolm to finish up our hour. Carolyn, thanks.
You're welcome.
Kenneth Sharp has been with us this hour. Looking forward, how can we change this? Do you see our technology, of course, will advance? Will our lack of practical wisdom in institutions get any better?
You know, to judge by the listeners who called in, I'm very optimistic. I mean, I feel like I could have come out there and spent a couple of hours on the phone with you and your listeners and written a second book, which would have been very similar. But you can see the desire people have to find institutional solutions and to act in their own lives in ways that allow them to do the right things, to do their work well. And they're doing it not because there's some big moral ought, but because they care about people and because this is the way they can do their work well. If you've got people like your callers out there, I think there's great reason for hope that people can change systems and change institutions so you can actually encourage the kind of judgment and empathy you need to do the right thing.
Kenneth Sharp is a political science professor at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. Together with Barry Schwartz, he has just come out with Practical Wisdom, the right way to do the right thing. And that's our program for today. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. And remember, podcasts and on-demand audio of River to River available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. And we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime at this email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. ¶¶